Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, we'll hear a recent lecture from Bowdoin College in Brunswick. The speaker is Dale Jamieson, a leading expert on climate change. His talk, titled The Ethics of Climate Change, was given as Bowdoin's Kenneth V. Santagata Memorial Lecture. For more information on this program, go to mpbn.net. where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs as well. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Crystal Collins Judd, Dean for Academic Affairs at Bowdoin.
Dale Jamieson's investigation of environmental issues, and particularly of climate warming, cuts across a huge swath of academic disciplines. He asks scientific, ethical, philosophical, and legal questions, all in the service of understanding critical environmental changes and what can be done about them. Professor Jamieson simultaneously holds appointments in philosophy, law, and environmental studies at New York University, and he also serves as director of environmental studies there. A truly interdisciplinary thinker, he has been honored with awards for his research in the social sciences and the humanities. He is also the author of several widely used treatises on environmental ethics, as well as over 100 articles and book chapters in the field. He is past president of the International Society for Environmental Ethics. Professor Jamieson will speak tonight on the ethics of climate change, specifically on an area that has been a focal point of much of his recent scholarship, the moral and political considerations involved in geoengineering as a response to climate warming. His talk, as you can see, is entitled Geoengineering as a Response to Climate Change, A Bad Concept Meets an Urgent Problem. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Dale Jamieson.
Well, first of all, I want to say how happy I am to be here and how honored I am to be giving this Santagata lecture. When I visit colleges like Bowdoin, it reminds me how important liberal arts colleges are for many reasons, including as incubators of the kind of interdisciplinary thinking that's characteristic of environmental studies, and how also important loyal and highly motivated alums like Mr. Santagata obviously was. And having heard a couple of stories about him at dinner tonight, I can only say it's my misfortune never to have met him. So I hope this lecture honors his memory as I intended to do. Geoengineering is back with a vengeance. A rush of new books and official reports urge us to think seriously about addressing climate change by painting roofs white, injecting reflective aerosols into the atmosphere, or even by launching space shields that would protect us from solar radiation. This newfound interest in geoengineering is partly a reaction to the steady increase in greenhouse gas emissions, which has continued despite scientific consensus, international treaties, and solemn declarations. In the background is the fact that many of us find Promethean solutions to urgent problems almost irresistibly attractive. In this lecture tonight, I will explain why conceptualizing climate change in the way that we do makes a hard problem more difficult. I'll begin with a very general characterization of the problem, then critically discuss the vocabulary of responses. I'll suggest that while some specific geoengineering proposals are worth considering and researching, the general category of geoengineering should be put to rest. I'll then express some concerns about some of the most frequently discussed geoengineering techniques and suggest that research should continue while arguing against proposals for initiating a dedicated, mission-driven geoengineering research program. I'll go on to say a little about how we should go forward in addressing climate change and what role various geoengineering technologies might have in this effort. And finally, I'll draw some conclusions. So first, then, the nature of the problem, just to make sure that we're all on the same page with the problem that we face. Now, almost everything about climate change is contested, at least by somebody. Whether it is occurring whether it is anthropogenic, whether it is a problem, whether it is soluble, what solutions are possible, and even what would count as a solution. These disputes are important, but I will put them aside, though I'll be happy to discuss any of them in the discussion period. The problem we face is that human action is increasing atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, which are in turn producing climate change. The greenhouse gases that are of greatest concern are carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and the halocarbons, a group of gases containing fluorine, chlorine, and bromine molecules. While these gases have different properties, they are often compared in terms of the construct global warming potential, with carbon dioxide stipulated as 1 and methane, for example, characterized as 72, meaning that each molecule of methane exerts 72 times the warming power over a 20-year period of a molecule of carbon dioxide. For present purposes, I'll focus mainly on carbon dioxide because it is the gas of greatest concern and because it is the one that is most widely discussed in the literature of geoengineering, though I will also sometimes speak of greenhouse gases in terms of carbon dioxide equivalents. Humans affect the atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide by manipulating both sinks and sources. Humans manipulate sources through such actions as burning fossil fuels, which increase emissions. Humans manipulate sinks by causing land use changes that reduce the ability of the biosphere to store carbon. Some actions, such as deforestation, can increase atmospheric carbon dioxide both by contributing to emissions and by reducing the ability of the biosphere to store carbon. Atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide are related to climate. In particular, high levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide are related to high mean surface temperatures. A doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide would produce a 1 degree centigrade warming were there no feedbacks in the climate system. However, because there are feedbacks, mostly relating to clouds, sea ice, and water vapor, a carbon dioxide doubling would likely produce a 2 to 4.5 degree centigrade warming. And this is the question of climate sensitivity. When people talk about climate sensitivity, they're talking about how much warming would be produced by a particular increase in atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. And if I can avail myself of a bad pun, the hottest controversies in climate science mostly concern the nature, strength, and sometimes even the identity of these feedbacks. Okay? So most of the controversies are not about the basic physics of climate change. It's really about the effect of the feedbacks. And as you can see, most of the feedbacks that we know about and identify and can quantify actually amplify warming rather than canceling warming. Now, the value associated with a particular increase in mean surface temperature, for example, 2 degrees centigrade, should be thought of as an index of the severity of climate change rather than as a prediction of temperature changes that would actually occur in any particular region. Any warming will produce more extreme events and higher regional temperatures, though some regions may not change or even become cooler. A more extreme warming will produce more extreme events and a greater likelihood of higher temperatures overall. The 194 parties to the Framework Convention on Climate Change are committed to the objective of stabilizing, and now I'm reading you a quotation, greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. What constitutes dangerous interference is a value judgment based on scientific information. There is widespread international agreement, but not consensus, about this value judgment. We should regard a 2 degree centigrade increase from the pre-industrial baseline as the threshold for dangerous interference with the climate system. According to the most widely accepted estimates, we would have to stabilize at atmospheric concentrations equivalent to 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide in order to have a 50% chance of not exceeding this 2 degree centigrade threshold. Since the 1992 signing of the Framework Convention, little has been done to effectively implement this commitment. Every year since 1992, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide has increased from a minimum of a little less than one part per million to a maximum of nearly three parts per million, averaging about two parts per million per year. The atmospheric concentration is currently about 388 parts per million, nearly 30% greater than the pre-industrial baseline of 275 parts per million. Global carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel burning have increased even more rapidly than atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide. Emissions have increased every year since 1992, and more than 36% overall. Even more worrisome, the underlying drivers of climate change remain out of control. Global population is currently growing at 1.2% per year, and the International Energy Agency projects an increase of 40% in primary energy demand from 2007 to 2030. If we take into account potential increases in other greenhouse gases, such as methane from increasing meat consumption, and the continuing loss of carbon sinks due to land use changes, the picture looks bleak indeed. Okay, so basically what's happened is since the countries of the world agreed in 1992 to tackle this problem, everything has gotten worse. Emissions have increased, concentrations have increased, the underlying drivers have increased. So it's not surprising then that attention increasingly is turning to various strategies that might help to compensate for this failure, and many of these strategies are clumped together under the rubric geoengineering, and those are the strategies I'm going to talk about tonight. Now, this is now section three on the vocabulary of responses. Now, early on in the climate change discussion, there was a tripartite division of possible responses: prevention, mitigation, and adaptation. And in those halcyon days, prevention referred to the possibility of preventing climate change. We now know that it was not possible to prevent climate change even then, much less now. Now, we can still envision preventing dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system, depending on how dangerous is defined, or at least preventing some of the worst consequences of climate change. But despite these possible uses, the language of prevention has largely dropped out of the climate change discussion. And so the tripartite division that's now in play is between mitigation, adaptation, and geoengineering. Now, mitigation in the climate change lexicon refers to reducing emissions. This is a perverse use of the term for two reasons. First, in its core meaning, mitigation refers to all measures that reduce the severity of an object of concern. The objects of concern in the climate change discussion are atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases and the climate they affect. Emissions reductions are intrinsically no more or less significant than other forms of manipulating sources and sinks that affect atmospheric concentrations. If we were to apply the term mitigation to reducing emissions, then the same term should also be applied to the entire range of sink and source manipulations that bear on atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. However, in the usual language of environmental policy, abatement is the term that is used to refer to actions that reduce pollutants of concern, and it is the natural term to use in this case. So we should simplify the climate change vocabulary by following this convention and refer to all measures that reduce atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases as abatement strategies. So in this view, proposals for carbon taxes or cap and trade systems for allocating emissions permissions are proposed abatement policies. We should reserve the term mitigation for approaches to reducing the severity of the climate effects of atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. Now, adaptation, as it is used in the climate change discussion, refers to a wide range of responses, from building floating houses to migration. People can adapt to climate change, but so can plants and animals. Adaptations can be distinguished on many different dimensions, including anticipatory reactive, conscious, non-conscious, and so on. Sometimes we plan to adapt, sometimes we just adapt. In general, adaptations are responses directed towards reducing the negative consequences of climate change. Now, one distinction that is important but difficult to draw precisely concerns the directness of the link between climate and the adaptation it engenders. For example, adapting new seed varieties or creating irrigation systems and migrating from an area of climate-driven economic, political, or social upheaval are all adaptations to climate change, yet they are very different. In the first case, adopting new seed varieties, the link between climate change and the adaptation seems more direct than in the second case, migration, in which the effects of climate change are mediated through a broad range of social, economic, and political institutions. However, it's difficult to make this distinction precise because it's difficult to distinguish climate, which after all is an abstraction, from its effects. And hovering in the background is the further muddy distinction between adapting to climate change and adapting to the effects of climate change. So I think we should be clear from the discussion so far that a great deal more work needs to be done, even to adequately conceptualize adaptation in the other terms of the debate. Now, geoengineering is a term whose origins are difficult to trace, but the idea has been in circulation for decades and perhaps centuries. In a 1961 address to the United Nations General Assembly, President John Kennedy declared his intention to propose further cooperative efforts between all nations in weather prediction and eventually in weather control. 4 years later, when President Johnson's Science Advisory Committee produced the first U.S. government report discussing climate change, the only responses that were considered were those that brought about, quoting, countervailing climate changes. Specifically mentioned was the possibility of covering thousands of square miles of ocean with reflective particles. Not a word was said about reducing carbon emissions. Okay, so when I said at the outset that geoengineering is back with a vengeance, it might have sounded strange because we think of geoengineering as this new possible desperate solution that people are proposing. But in fact, almost as soon as climate change was starting to become an issue, geoengineering was on the agenda for response. Now, there's serious disagreement about exactly which technologies count as geoengineering. There's a recent report from the British Royal Society which discussed at least 16 different techniques ranging from ocean upwelling to space-based reflectors. In 1996, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Thomas Schelling characterized geoengineering as implying, quote, something global, intentional, and unnatural. Now, I think the first two criteria are clear. Geoengineering technologies are directed towards intentionally manipulating climate. The idea of the unnatural is less clear. But I think what Schelling is gesturing at is that these technologies are new and untried, or they're technologies that are being put to new or untried uses. Now, geoengineering is a kind of grab bag or Rube Goldberg category, in part because scientists and engineers from different research traditions and disciplinary backgrounds have all forwarded proposals that reflect their own interests, both scientific and economic. Oceanographers, chemists, physicists, and engineers have all been advocates of some kinds of geoengineering technologies or research. Some proposed geoengineering responses, sometimes called carbon dioxide removal techniques, would reduce atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide by increasing sinks, for example, by fertilizing the ocean with iron, or by capturing carbon directly from the air capture. Now, in principle, these techniques are no different from any other attempt at managing sinks. And like other attempts to reduce a pollutant of concern, these carbon dioxide removal techniques should be thought of as abatement strategies. Okay? So what I'm saying is that part of geoengineering that is about removing carbon dioxide should really be thought of not in some special category of geoengineering, but as essentially attempts to abate pollution. Now, the other proposed techniques are solar radiation management techniques, and they would affect the Earth's mean surface temperature by affecting albedo, by, for example, painting surfaces white, or by blocking solar radiation, for example, sun shields, or reflecting solar radiation back into space, for example, stratospheric aerosol injection or space mirrors. These approaches are importantly different from abatement, since they would not reduce the atmospheric concentrations of the pollutants of concern. Instead, they would mitigate the climatic effects of atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. So for that reason, I think of solar radiation management techniques as mitigation strategies. So I'm not the only person now to suggest linguistic reform is a good step towards improving policy. For example, Plato and Confucius both thought that rectifying names and getting the language straight was actually the beginning of thinking clearly about an issue. And it's also possible to challenge the distinctions that I've suggested on various grounds. So some may be bothered by the fact that, on my account, one and the same response can fall into more than one category. So, for example, painting roofs white can be viewed both as an adaptation to climate change and as an instance of mitigation. But despite these overlapping categories, and in some cases the lack of sharp distinctions, I think this vocabulary that I'm trying to urge on you is actually helpful and more illuminating for discussing responses to climate change than the standard vocabulary. And I'm now going to try to explain why. A consequence of my vocabulary is that we can discuss specific geoengineering proposals without accepting the idea that there's some general category of response that can usefully be thought of as geoengineering. So to put my point prescriptively, I'm saying we should talk about specific geoengineering proposals and stop talking about geoengineering in general. Now, why should we stop talking about geoengineering in general? Well, one reason is because the concept is too broad. Technologies as diverse as space mirrors and white roofs are encompassed by this term. Moreover, the category is arbitrary. Tree planting isn't geoengineering, while installing an artificial tree is, even if their carbon sequestration effects are identical. When humans and beavers build dams, why not say that both are geoengineering? Perhaps even the little girl Ricky Kimberly is geoengineering when she builds a sandcastle on the Jersey Shore. Now, it may be objected that these are not examples of geoengineering, since geoengineering is supposed to be global in scope. But it's a subtle distinction between installing an artificial tree or dumping some iron filings at sea, acts that are very local and small scale that are intended to have global repercussions, and Ricky Kimberly sandcastle, which in some small way does in fact change the Earth. Geoengineering does not have easily drawn intuitive boundaries, and it seems too ubiquitous to mark a useful category. Now, the most serious objection to treating geoengineering as a distinct category is that it invites us to see an entire class of strategies as a categorical rival to those approaches to climate change that are conventionally classed as mitigation and adaptation. However, the real problem we face is not in choosing the right class of responses, but rather in selecting and implementing a portfolio of particular strategies for responding to a problem that is urgent, multidimensional, and extended in space and time. Moreover, because geoengineering is typically treated as nearly cost-free, and only to be used in the bottom of the ninth, there may be a tendency to exempt proposals that are classed in this way from the critical scrutiny that we give to other proposals for responding to climate change, for example, building nuclear power plants. After all, when it comes to preventing the explosion of a ticking bomb, we can take steps that would not otherwise be justified. The picture that many people have is that implementing geoengineering technologies would be like giving an experimental drug to a dying patient. The usual norms and ethical principles would not apply. Geoengineering has even been called Plan B, as if it were the morning after pill for societies that don't practice safe consumption. Thank you. You don't know how awful it feels to have a little joke like that buried in a dense text that no one notices. Geoengineering is supposed to be the backstop that's going to gather up all those wild carbon molecules that are not otherwise being caught. Now, if metaphors were arguments, geoengineering would be home free. What these metaphors have in common is that they are meant to bring out a distinctive role that geoengineering proposals are supposed to play, in contrast to those technologies classed as mitigation and adaptation. I do not believe that geoengineering technologies play a distinctive role, nor do I believe that there is a special set of norms that apply to them, or that such proposals should be exempted from norms that would otherwise apply, simply because they have been brought together in this weedy category called geoengineering. It is important to interrogate each particular geoengineering proposal for ethical, political, social, and economic acceptability in the same way that we examine other proposals for responding to climate change. And so I'm now going to begin that interrogation by talking about some concerns about what is traditionally called geoengineering. So I'm going to leave my language behind now and speak of these proposals in the way that most people do. So in this section now, I'm going to discuss various concerns that have been expressed about what is called geoengineering. And some of these concerns are broader than just geoengineering, and others attached to particular geoengineering proposals. So the first thing I'll just briefly mention is unintended consequences. As is typical in the discussion of technological innovation, considerable concern has been expressed about the possibility of unintended consequences. These concerns have ranged from the possibility that sulfate aerosol injection will disrupt the Indian monsoon, thus leading to massive starvation, to the observation that phytoplankton blooms stimulated by iron fertilization can result in the secretion of toxins at concentrations that can be harmful to marine life. Now, these are important and serious considerations, but I want to focus on others that have received less attention than they deserve. And so this takes me to magic bullets. Even under very optimistic assumptions, there is no geoengineering technology that is a magic bullet, to use another metaphor, for addressing the problem of climate change. Particular geoengineering technologies would solve some problems caused by our greenhouse gas emissions while neglecting or exacerbating others. Even if we were successful in reducing mean surface temperatures, sulfate aerosol injection would likely produce substantial regional variations in temperature, precipitation, and the intensity of the hydrological cycle. And as I've mentioned, perhaps even disrupting the Indian monsoon. Now, in 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, and many consider this a natural experiment in sulfate aerosol injection. Now, the eruption of Mount Pinatubo produced a substantial decrease in precipitation over land masses and even brought drought to some parts of the tropics. In any case, sulfate injection would do nothing to address related problems such as ocean acidification. Even worse, if we were to embark on any solar radiation management program while continuing to increase the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, we would risk catastrophic climate change if we were to lose the capacity or will to manage solar radiation any time during the next millennium or beyond. In other words, we'd have to keep injecting these sulfate aerosols to mask the warming. And this would be an enormous challenge since, as I say, sulfate aerosols would have to be replenished frequently, perhaps even on an annual basis. And it's worth thinking about whether there have been any human societies that have been able to manage anything for 1,000 years. You know, you can think about maybe some irrigation systems in the ancient Near East as examples, but it's certainly hard to think of modern democratic societies as being capable of this. Now, carbon dioxide removal strategies avoid some of these risks, but depending on the rate of removal, could themselves have unpredictable climate effects. It would also be extremely difficult to create the infrastructure for a program that would affect, would be scaled up enough to affect global climate and could also successfully sequester carbon for centuries or millennia. But the most immediate and direct threat of such programs would be to local ecosystems. Okay, so declaring a climate emergency. Many people think that geoengineering technologies should be developed, but only deployed, and often this military word, deployed, is used, in case of a climate emergency. Now, this raises several questions. How do we know when we are experiencing a climate emergency? Who has the authority to declare such an emergency? Could geoengineering technologies be deployed in a timely way to save us from the threat once an emergency was declared? There are several problems with knowing when we are in a climate emergency. The first problem is that one person's emergency is another person's bad day at the office. Today, there are people living in drought-stricken parts of the world who would say that a climate emergency has already arrived. While rich people in fortunate regions may be able to cope fairly successfully with even relatively extreme future climate change. Like the idea of dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system, the concept of a climate emergency is value-laden. While this isn't sufficient to forestall agreement, there's a great deal of agreement, for example, about what constitutes a medical emergency, it does complicate matters, especially since climate, as I've noted, is abstract, and many of its most dramatic effects are indirect. Now, recognizing this difficulty, Bart Gordon, who is the now former chair of the House Committee on Science and Technology, said that, quote, the global climate science and policy communities should work towards consensus on what constitutes a climate emergency. So you see, the issue is taken seriously enough that you have reports being written, statements being made by House committees. Now, these are noble sentiments, I think, but when it comes to such a profound issue on which so much hinges, a consensus between global climate science and policy communities would be difficult to achieve. And even if such a consensus were achieved, it's unclear how much this consensus between scientific and policy elites, how much that would represent a consensus among the peoples of the world. Now, a more serious problem is that the effects of climate change occur over centuries and even millennia. Were we able to see clearly from here all the effects of the greenhouse gases that we have already emitted, perhaps we would agree that a climate emergency is already upon us. In other words, in 2300, you know, this, people may look back and say the emergency occurred in 2010. The problem is that we cannot see all the effects of our emissions because they are so dissociated, temporally and otherwise, from their causes. Not only does this make it difficult for us to know whether we are in a climate emergency, but it leads to a further problem. By the time we might come to an agreement that we are in a climate emergency, there may be little to do but watch it unfold. Or perhaps at that stage, the appropriate response would be attempts at radical adaptation and survival, rather than trying to exert control over climate. An even more troubling question concerns who has the authority to declare such a climate emergency. There is a great deal of talk in the geoengineering community about the importance of what is called governance. But at the same time, there is concern that any truly inclusive governance process would not be able to act decisively in the face of a climate emergency. For example, look at the glacial pace of negotiations about a climate treaty under the Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's hard to be optimistic about responding to a real emergency. Now, it might be said, I think, perhaps unfairly, that many in the geoengineering community think that governance is good so long as it rapidly comes to the right decisions. But, of course, many of us are tempted to think the same about democracy. There are very serious issues at stake here. Intentionally changing climate is a way of exerting power on a global scale in a context in which relevant norms, conventions, and treaties barely exist, are highly ineffectual, or very controversial. Now, John von Neumann was one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, the inventor of game theory, the creator of one of the standard interpretations of quantum mechanics, one of the really founders of computer science and the creator of the first weather and climate models. And in 1955, he predicted, quote, intervention in atmospheric and climatic matters will unfold on a scale difficult to imagine at present. This will merge each nation's affairs with those of every other more thoroughly than the threat of a nuclear or any other war would have done, unquote. Climate change, whether inadvertent or intentional, involves winners and losers at many different scales. Even countries that would benefit from geoengineering value their autonomy and right to engage in decision-making. Any attempt to assume the authority to geoengineer without broad international agreement would be extremely divisive and even disruptive. Indeed, outside the geoengineering communities in the United States and Great Britain, suspicion about these activities is already very great. In Nagoya, Japan, in 2010, the parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, a treaty that the United States has signed but not ratified, declared a moratorium on geoengineering research that would affect biodiversity. Now, it's surprising that the Convention on Biological Diversity even took an interest in geoengineering, but what's not surprising is that were they to take an interest, that the interest would be skeptical and critical. It's difficult to even imagine what would be the correct principles of procedural justice to invoke in the case of geoengineering. Geoengineering would presumably affect every living thing on Earth, and perhaps even all those who will live in the future. It's surely too much to require that everyone who is affected must participate in a decision in order for it to be legitimate. I am affected by your opening a donut shop across the street from mine, but I have no right to participate in your decision to open the shop, except perhaps in the most general and indirect way. And even if we assume that nations are the proper decision makers for geoengineering, it leaves open the question of the threshold of agreement that is required, a majority of nations, consensus. And it also leaves open the question of the institutional location of the decision-making process. It's sometimes suggested that the UN Security Council would be the most appropriate institution for authorizing geoengineering. But the moral authority of the Security Council is itself in question, and it's not clear that the UN Charter actually gives the Security Council competence over such matters as control of global climate. Now, one possibility would be to restructure the Framework Convention on Climate Change so that it incorporates two bodies, one that mirrors the Security Council and the other that mirrors the General Assembly. The Conference of the Parties of the Framework Convention mirroring the General Assembly would operate according to majority vote rather than consensus, as it does currently. A new body would be composed of the world's largest nations. Mirroring the Security Council, it would have the authority to take strong, decisive action, but unanimous consent would be required. Such a picture both reflects the vision of a reasonable reform of the UN Security Council and also expresses the idea that decisions regarding climate change are of the same gravity as those regarding military intervention. Too bad this proposal has little chance of adoption. Now, I think one plausible conclusion that can be drawn from this miasma of uncertainty is that the more likely a test is to be legitimating, the less likely it is that geoengineering will be authorized. As a result, if geoengineering technologies are deployed, they are likely to be deployed without moral authority by the same people who have caused a large share of inadvertent climate change and have evaded the difficult decisions that would be required to reduce emissions. In other words, the same people who brought you climate change will be here to save you from it. Okay, this leads us to moral hazards. Many people, even some prominent proponents of geoengineering, such as David Keith, have expressed concern that geoengineering research will distract us from the basic challenge of reducing carbon emissions. I believe that talk about geoengineering has already, to some extent, contributed to dampening our willingness to reduce emissions. As I've mentioned, people were already talking about geoengineering in the 1960s. The historian Jim Fleming here, who's from Colby College near here, has demonstrated that there has been unbroken interest in geoengineering and weather modification for decades and even centuries. And I'm going now to just to provide one example of how the supposed possibility of geoengineering has continued to figure in the climate policy debate. The economist William Nordhaus, writing in Science magazine in 1992, immediately after the Rio Earth Summit, the adoption of the Framework Convention, and the promise by the United States and other developed countries to stabilize their greenhouse gas emissions, wrote the following, quoting Nordhaus now. Geoengineering would introduce a hypothetical technology that provides costless mitigation of climate change. This could occur, for example, if one of the geoengineering options proved technically feasible and environmentally benign. Two interesting proposals include shooting smart mirrors into space with 16-inch naval rifles, or seeding the oceans with iron to accelerate carbon sequestration. The dream of geoengineering, quote, costless mitigation of climate change, unquote, has been a constant, if ghostly, presence in the climate change debate. And I believe it has already functioned as a moral hazard with respect to greenhouse gas emissions reductions. We prefer certain decisive action, free of politics, to messy, indeterminate responses that affect the way that we live. If the certain decisive action is both costless and implemented by firing large weapons, what could be better? My fear is that geoengineering will increasingly become a moral hazard with respect to adaptation as well, driving out funding, especially for the poorest populations who have done the least to cause climate change. Geoengineering is increasingly being marketed as a technology that will most benefit those poor people, precisely because they will suffer most from climate change. On Plan B, rather than spending trillions to curb our emissions, adapt or compensate victims, we'll give our own scientists billions to prevent the bad consequences from climate change ever occurring. It is this emerging vision that presents the second and currently most threatening moral hazard posed by geoengineering. So this takes us then to, I think, a very complicated question about human arrogance. Geoengineering strikes many people as arrogant, both because it fails to show respect for nature and because it is of a piece with the attitudes that have been implicated in causing the problem it purports to solve. Indeed, many of our environmental problems flow from attempts to manipulate nature in order to make it conform to our desires, rather than shaping our desires in response to nature. We have, quote, improved nature in many ways, bringing water to places where people want to live, exterminating animals who prey on animals we raise for food, dredging harbors and filling wetlands so towns and cities can be developed, and so on. Although it's not possible or desirable for humans to always, quote, let nature take its course, there is a growing sense that modern societies have erred on the side of excessive intervention, that we have become arrogant and intrusive in attempting to manage all elements of nature. Now, one response to this concern is to say that geoengineering is directed towards reversing the inadvertent climate change that people are already bringing about. The goal of geoengineering is to return the climate system to its, quote, original state before humans began to affect it. Now, one may ask what counts as the original state of climate, and why it should be preferred. If we're able to get our hands on the global thermostat, why should we settle for anything less than the best? Why not optimize climate, whatever that would mean, rather than returning to some historical baseline that itself was just a moment in the long history of the planet? But putting this question aside, many people would simply respond to the claim that geoengineering would be an attempt to right a wrong by saying that rather than righting a wrong, geoengineering would just add a second wrong to the first, and that two wrongs do not make a right. Indeed, many people would say that the second wrong of intentionally changing climate would be worse than the first wrong of inadvertently changing climate, even if this second wrong returned us to the original climate. Now, this common sense view that I think actually many people have intuitively presupposes that there is a moral asymmetry between what is brought about intentionally and what is an inadvertent result of an action. And while I don't believe that common sense can be fully defended on this point, it is surely not generally true that intentionally performing some act is morally equivalent to or not worse than inadvertently performing the same act. Intentionally running over a pedestrian is generally regarded as worse than doing so inadvertently or accidentally. Indeed, when trying to evade responsibility for an action, people often claim that what happened was not what they intended. I didn't mean to do it. In some cases, intentionality is even crucial to how acts are classified. Intentionally running down a pedestrian is murder. Inadvertently killing the pedestrian is an accident. Intentional deception is lying. Inadvertent deception is leaving a false impression. Now, there's much more to say here, but the simple thought that geoengineering cannot be an act of human arrogance because it's an attempt to right a wrong or its equivalent but better intentioned version of an act that we do not consider arrogant simply does not follow. Now, what drives the view that geoengineering would be an act of human arrogance is the idea that geoengineering would disrupt a relationship that is as old as humanity. Until relatively recently, human lives were lived against the background of natural events that were beyond human control. But rather than providing the background against which human lives unfold and take on meaning, nature is increasingly becoming another human artifact. The idea that even climate could become a human creation is seen by many as a deep rupture in the fabric that brought humanity into existence and over millennia provided the context and conditions for giving meaning to human life. Okay. So, two more sections. The risks of research. Now, most geoengineering advocates say that what they want is not deployment, but a dedicated research program. The program would start small, but could gear up to the scale of the Manhattan Project. They claim that there is a bright line between research and deployment. Bright lines, however, have a way of fading, particularly when it comes to dedicated research programs. In 1983, President Reagan created the Strategic Defense Initiative, a program devoted to developing technologies that would protect the American homeland from nuclear attack. Despite large costs and widespread opposition from many of the nation's leading scientists, Reagan's initiative has survived in some form for more than a quarter century, focusing on different technologies and wrapping itself in different purposes. It led the United States to withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002, increased international tensions on numerous occasions, and siphoned money away from valuable purposes towards technological fantasies. Large research initiatives can be tougher to kill than vampires. They feed fortunes, careers, and reputations. As with the Strategic Defense Initiative, a dedicated geoengineering research program risks creating a self-amplifying cycle of interest groups and lobbies, building momentum towards eventual deployment as a way of justifying the research. A dedicated geoengineering research program is especially dangerous in the current unstable policy environment, in which there is a large amount of goodwill backed by large sums of money in a context in which there is little regulation. At least one company, Plankto, set sail in an attempt to fertilize the ocean, hoping to be capitalized by the carbon offset market. In 2008, the voluntary carbon offset market was estimated to be worth more than $700 million. Successful attempts to appeal to this market could eventually lead to being part of a regulated offset market, potentially worth billions of dollars. It's not too difficult to imagine that something like the medical pharmaceutical complex could emerge, in which research, deployment, marketing, and government policy are closely linked and mutually reinforcing. Given the huge sums at stake, It's not surprising that the push for a dedicated government-supported research program is so strong and comes from so many different directions. What is often ignored is that, according to the General Accounting Office, the United States government already spends upwards of $50 million per year in geoengineering-related research. This in addition to private spending by people like Bill Gates, for example, who are funding this area. Now, there is a case for better coordination and perhaps for increased funding, but it matters enormously how the research is conceptualized, what agencies lead, and whether it is regarded as mission-driven or basic research. Okay, so this leads me then to my final section, the way forward, a portfolio of responses. In the next few years, climate policy is likely to be driven by national and regional efforts rather than by large schemes and big dreams about global cooperation. In every country, there are political divisions about how to respond to climate change, and domestic politics in every country will become even more important in determining the global response. U.S. policy in the next several years will be driven by the effectiveness and resiliency of such laws, policies, and institutions as REGI, California's climate change laws and policies, attempts to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act, and the vast amount of litigation slowly working its way through the courts. One area that's not, I think, well understood by the public is how many court cases have been filed against coal-burning plants and so on. And it's under the radar now because these cases are working their way through the lower courts, but they're getting a surprising amount of traction. A lot of these cases I thought would be thrown out on sort of grounds of standing and so on, but many of them are surviving. Now, in this environment, it's even more important to think in terms of wedges than it was when the idea was first put forward in 2004 by Steve Pakala and Rob Sokolow. Now, for those of you who don't remember that paper, they essentially argued that there was no single solution to the climate change problem. We should just think out to a 2050 horizon, and we should think in terms of how to take bites out of the problem, using a vast array of technologies and possibilities that were already available. And I think that way of thinking is even more important now than it was when it was originally proposed, although now we have to think out beyond 2050. Some geoengineering technologies may have a place in our portfolio of responses, but they will have to compete against renewable energy projects, conservation programs, adaptation responses, and other alternatives on grounds of cost, feasibility, and moral and political acceptability. Even geoengineering research will have to compete against other research, such as proposals that investigate new energy sources. It's important to recognize that the United States today spends only about 40% in constant dollars on energy research compared to what we spent in 1976. Now, there are many questions about this proposal that I'm going to leave unanswered. For example, what counts as a candidate for inclusion in the portfolio of responses? We don't, for example, consider enforcing a one-child policy as a response to climate change, though it would be a very effective response to climate change. And it raises questions about whether there are moral constraints on what we can consider as a response to climate change, and if so, what are these constraints? But despite all these questions that can be asked, many of which I think you probably will ask, still, some things are clear about the approach that I've begun to sketch. For example, it's clear that this approach, the portfolio approach, amounts to abandoning the Promethean dream of a certain decisive solution to the climate change problem. It instead requires that we engage or re-engage with the messy world of small-ball climate politics. We have created a problem of climate change, and we must mobilize all of our resources in addressing it. But there is no single response or category of responses that will constitute a solution. The threat we face is real, but John Wayne is dead, and there is no Colt 45 peacemaker even to launch stratospheric aerosols in sight. Thank you very much. Okay, so I'm not sure what time it is, but I know we have time for questions. Yeah.
Fantastic talk. I have a quick question about language, and maybe this is me misunderstanding it, but it seems that implicit in your talk, another type of language or word that might need to be rethink, you know, think through again is crisis, because we always talk about crisis, and crisis engenders a type of quick response, like Rooster Cogburn pulling out the Colt 45, to use your final metaphor. Is that, am I fair to see that's one of the implicit messages in your talk, that the very notion of thinking about a crisis creates both paralysis and at the same time perhaps not very well thought out responses?
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, it's very difficult to stay in crisis mode for a century or a millennium. And I think that's part of the problem. And indeed, it's just at a political level, it's one of my objections, really, to... Well, I have to be very careful about how I say this. I mean, I feel very supportive of almost every group that tries to address this problem or any idea that anyone tries to float. But there's an organization called 350.org, for example, that's been quite influential in the last couple of years. And my concern about 350.org is that it kind of creates this mentality that there is a bright line, and we are over 350, right? And so the idea is once we get over that line, what happens? We've lost the game, the world comes to an end, we stop, the crisis is over, we lost. Sorry, we're going to go to 400, we're going to go to 450. This is going to be a long twilight struggle to slow the change and to decrease to the greatest extent possible the extremity of the change. And that's, you're absolutely right, not crisis thinking. That requires a different kind of commitment. So, good point.
Thanks. I'm speaking far from my area of expertise, or asking a question far from my area. You talked about the issue of population growth. And the interesting wrinkle to that, I think, that question about control of population growth is that the countries with the highest population growth rate are very often countries on a per capita basis which contribute very little to climate change. And the countries that have relatively modest growth, like the U.S., is when we're on a per capita basis, we have an enormous impact. And so it leads me to wonder how you structure or a response to population growth in a moral framework in this context.
Well, so let me complicate your comment a little bit and then give you a very simple response. So I want to complicate your question a little bit by saying that it isn't just population growth rates we need to think about, because population growth rates are historical. So if you take China, for example, which has a low population growth rate, which follows a hugely high fertility rate during the period of the heyday of Maoism and so on, and relatively high compared to India, for example, per capita emissions. And the United States, for example, has a relatively high fertility rate, population growth rate, compared to European countries that have lower per capita emissions. So the story is a little more complicated. But having said that, I think from an ethical point of view, it's very simple. We don't want poor people on the planet in the sense of people who are living on $2 a day. We want everyone to have a decent life. And we know that having a decent life, at least as we understand that in the present context, involves using energy. And we don't have a lot of options to the use of fossil fuel energy at this point. So what we know is that if we're adding 1.2% population to the world every year, as we currently are, and we want them to have a good life, then we're going to want them to use some energy. Not at the rate at which Americans use energy, probably not even at the rate at which Swedes use energy. But we know that insofar as we aspire that everyone have a good life, there's going to be some relationship between population and climate change, until, anyway, we get to a world in which we've decarbonized energy entirely. And so that's why population growth rate, wherever it is going to have some effect on what any reasonable person would want for an environmental future.
Could you talk at all about how nuclear power might play a role in this conversation? You brought it up a little bit earlier, and Just could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I have this paper on energy policy that's called Grasping the Nettle. And I like the metaphor because generating energy involves transforming nature. The transformation of nature can always be viewed as the degradation of nature, because essentially degradation is an unwanted change of state, if you will. So there's no way of generating energy that is without some cost in some sense. And we've attached different meanings to these costs at different times. So I can remember the good old days of the early environmental movement when people would write songs about how nice wood fires smelled, you know, and what a horrible thing nuclear power was. Wood was holy, sacred, natural, you know, nuclear, bad, scary, and so on. But now we see carbon emissions as being probably a sharper nettle to grasp than the issue of the storage of nuclear waste. So I think almost anyone who's serious about trying to deal with the climate change problem has to at least be open to taking seriously the new generation of nuclear power plants that can be built and have been built in various parts of the world. And indeed, the real secret, really, for why the Europeans, yes, they're virtuous. Yes, they're good. They're, you know, they're much more virtuous than we are. We all know that. And they have better wine. But the real secret for why European emissions are less than ours is because of the widespread use of nuclear power, which the French have maintained, for example, the system with a high degree of safety and efficiency now for a very great period of time. The problem with nuclear power, besides the obvious one of nuclear waste storage and the terrorist magnet concern, right, is the time horizon, is the time scale. How quickly can nuclear plants be built and deployed to actually make a difference in terms of how far over the 2-degree centigrade threshold we go? And part of why we can't answer that question is because, this country still does not have an energy policy. So I guess what I'm saying is nuclear power has to be part of the portfolio I'm talking about, and it would be an attractive piece of that portfolio. But we can't really think of any one of these pieces in isolation without thinking about what a strategy actually is to manage this transition into the greenhouse world. And without that kind of systematic thinking, it's very hard to make these decisions on a piece-by-piece basis.
I really enjoyed your talk, and I'm wondering how you get this message to the people who make decisions about this, because all of us are now informed, but I'm assuming no one's going to make the decision tomorrow to...
Well, you actually talk to them when they're college students, and then...
Go on, sorry.
That's my question, is how, besides talking to college students, how do you get the message to the Senate or the UNFCC or other people who are really powerful, and I guess I assume they have more power to make a decision than I do at this point?
Well, you know, the problem we have in the United States, there's kind of two dimensions to this problem. The environmental impulse was not a partisan political impulse until the first 2 years of the first Reagan administration, 1980 to 1982, when President Reagan appointed a particularly venal and incompetent group of people to be in the Department of Interior and EPA and so on. And that began the politicization of the environmental movement because, among other things, not only were these people horrible and ideological, the environmental community discovered that they were really good for fundraising, right? And so that began the kind of political polarization around environmental questions. Now, climate change, of all environmental issues, was relatively late to be politicized precisely because of the nuclear side of it. So the environmental groups were not crazy about taking climate change seriously because that could mean nuclear power. And people who weren't so keen on environmental issues thought, well, this could mean nuclear power. But what happened is that the climate change issue has evolved into an issue where it has become a partisan litmus test. And so virtually, you know, it's almost to the point for Republicans where, saying that climate science is a fraud is just part of the same litany as being pro-life. And you have Democrats who don't know a molecule from their mother who think, oh, we need aggressive climate action, you know. And this is a terrible disservice to the difficulty and complexity of this kind of a problem. So the first step is to somehow try to suck the political heat out of the climate issue, because, you know, the atmosphere doesn't care whether it's a Republican or a Democrat who's driving the SUV that's doing the emitting. Now, how you do that? Who wants to do that? Everyone seems very happy with partisan politics, as far as I can tell. At least the partisans are.
Yeah, could you address the nature and scope of the current research and testing, specifically what are we doing in labs and what are we doing out in the open environment, and also the degree to which we have actually begun to implement some of these strategies?
So things are happening in two different levels, so to speak. So most of the solar radiation management stuff is just conceptual, although the Russians did do a sulfate aerosol injection experiment, but it didn't actually, which involved firing, you know, sulfates out of a gun that didn't actually get very high and ended up just creating a kind of local cloud of pollution and choking, you know, a small village or something. So there have been that, if that's an experiment. There have been small-scale, unauthorized iron fertilization experiments. I mean, in one early one, basically some iron filings were dumped in the ocean. It created a phytoplankton bloom, which created a zooplankton bloom. They ate all the phytoplankton, and that was that. So there have been kind of these little silly things like that. Now, the carbon dioxide removal stuff is interesting because there's two important actors here. One is Klaus Lochner, and the other is David Keith, and they both have private companies to basically develop these technologies. And as a result, much of the and they claim that their research is very far advanced, but much of the information is proprietary, and so it's actually difficult to know. So what this community, the one thing all these people agree about, so one thing that's kind of interesting, you go to these geoengineering meetings, and you have oceanographers, and you have engineers, and you have, you know, atmospheric chemists, and all these different people, and they all basically think that each other is a fraud, you know. But what they all agree about is that the government should create a crash research program for geoengineering. And that's really what unites this community and brings it together. And it's quite likely to happen. Something like some mission-driven geoengineering research program is likely to be created by the United States government, maybe in combination with the British government. There's enormous momentum that comes from two places. One place are climate scientists, some fraction of climate scientists, who really believe this problem is so desperate and so serious and so urgent that we have to do something. And people like oceanographers in some many ways who really just want to get funding to do basic research. It's like with HIV, you know, lots of people who did basic biological research suddenly discovered they were HIV researchers, you know, when there was money for HIV. So some of it is that, and some of it is just, you know, are these people who are going into private business and having private actors. So there's a kind of gathering cloud, if you will, and probably some kind of research program will be created. The question is how large, how it will be managed, and whether, in fact, we can maintain bright lines between research and deployment if that happens.
All right. I'm losing my voice, so I'll make it quick. So I really enjoyed the talk. I think that you're in an ideal world. You're absolutely right. We need to look at, you know, small, incremental sort of approach to this problem. But I think, like, what's basically popping into my mind is that, you know, trying to actually create that sort of change in a political environment of today is very difficult to get, you know, that message across the American public who, you know, have, you know, very short attention span, to say the least. So...
Wait, what's that you said?
So, I've heard things like if you build like a solar farm that's like, you know, 10 square miles in Arizona, that creates enough electricity to power the whole U.S. or something like that. And I don't know, that's probably incorrect in some way, but like what? Okay. So, but I guess like my question is, why not do large scale projects like that? Maybe geoengineering has, you know, certain problems associated with it, but doing those large scale, you know, projects, you know, maybe making a comparison to the Manhattan project that you said before, like, you know, that can sort of actually, you can get people excited about it, and that might be something that in the current political climate, you know, you could actually push through. It might not be ideal, but it might be, you know, something that would make a difference.
Okay, so that's a good question. And since it's late, I'll try not to give a long answer, but to some extent I'll probably fail, because it is a good question. So the first thing to say is that in some sense, if you just look at this as an energy issue, which is just one piece of it, but an important piece of it, there's kind of a fork in responses, which is there's either going to be large projects or there's not. Now, if there's not going to be large projects, what that's going to mean is that eventually it'll be like you buy a house and it kind of maybe comes with its own energy system, which may be more or less efficient and more or less intermittent and so on and so forth. And we'll just kind of accept that, sort of like if you live in the country, you have a well or something. Or we will have big projects, and big projects will involve things like the reconstruction of the grid into the so-called smart grid, which is going to involve lots of land use issues and right-of-way issues and so on and so forth. It'd be things like big wind farms, which it only took 8 years, you know, to get one authorized, you know, within sight of the Kennedy compound, you know, off the Cape. Or large arrays of solar collectors, large windmill farms, which also have terrible siting problems, although we're making some progress. But there have to be much, much, much larger scale alternative energy projects than anything that we've done so far. So we're going to go one way or the other. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dale Jamieson and his speech on the ethics of climate change, which took place recently at Bowdoin College in Brunswick. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can find it online at mpbn.net.